Welcome back, everyone, to Tribal Theocrat Live. It's April 6th, 2013. I'm Christian Gray. And today we have a very exciting show lined up with Justin Cottrell, who's here to talk about the Oklahoma City bombing. Just a brief announcement about some upcoming shows. April 20th, we'll more than likely have on an agrarian to talk about that system versus industrialism. It's not 100% lined up, so I don't want to jinx it, but we'll explore Christian agrarianism and versus industrialism from a biblical worldview. And then May 4th, we will likely have a guest on to talk about the case for the South and life during the forced integration years and why the South must rise again. So more information coming up on those two shows in the future. But today we're here to discuss the Oklahoma City bombing, which happened almost 18 years ago on Wednesday, April 19th, 1995. And if you want to ask a question to our guest, you can head over to tribaltheocrat.com and click the chat on the top menu. And we'll try to answer those questions toward the end. Our guest to discuss it is Justin Cottrell. He's been on the show before. He's an author and researcher and family man, and he's a former OKC firefighter. Welcome, Justin.
Howdy. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Good deal. Well, tell me when you want to dig in, and I'll dig right in.
Yeah. I think that we'll just go ahead and dig in, set the stage for what we're talking about tonight, as well as your background here.
Okay. Well, I'll just kind of, you know, I'm going to cover a lot of bases tonight, from the official story to what I saw there at the Oklahoma City bombing at the Murrah Building, to the contradictions and the implications of what all this means to us. But, you know, to tie all this together, I'm going to start with a little bit of my history, too. My family settled in Oklahoma City during the land run of 1889. I've got deep roots there. I had a great-great-grandfather immigrated from Finland and had a hardware store and a bed and breakfast just a few blocks from where the Murrah Building stood. And I had another great-grandfather who actually settled in the land run that had a library just a few blocks southwest of the Murrah Building. So, like I said, I've got deep roots in the area. And with that, I got hired on the Oklahoma City Fire Department October 7th of 1994. I went through 3 or 4 months of training. I think it was 3 months. And then I was stationed at Station 6, which is just right down the street from the Murrah Building. And from there, I went to Station 21. Station 21 was the busiest station in Oklahoma and one of the busiest stations nationwide. We averaged between 12 and 21 fire calls a day. You know, most of them were accidents and medical calls, but the point is, still calls. We're very busy. And April the 18th, I was on duty that day, and the day before, I'd gone with my fiance, who I'm now married to, and we had got some lawn equipment. It was my first house. I was 21 years old and thought, you know what, I need to get a lawnmower, a chainsaw, a weed eater, and all that stuff. So we went and got it, and I was going to work on the yard the 19th. And so the 18th, I was rip-roaring ready to go, but I had one little hang-up. I was told for weeks and weeks before the 18th that even though I'd been on the fire department for 6 months, they did not have a copy of my Social Security card on file. And so they told me where I could get one. And the only place in Oklahoma City at the time was in the Murrah Building. It was on the first floor. And so me and my bride-to-be, we went there probably, I'm guessing, 3 or 4 weeks before the bombing, and maybe 2 weeks somewhere in there. And they told me, they said, well, we cannot issue a card because you don't have a certified copy of your birth certificate. My mom had given me a photocopy. That wasn't good enough. I had to have the signed, sealed, and approved version. And so I got that. I went and requested one because my mom, for some reason, wouldn't let me loose with it. And so I got one. And the morning of the 19th was the day that I'd actually planned to go there. And it's just, it's weird the way the coincidence is. But I got off from Station 21 and drove north from there up I-44, one of the interstates there. And I got off early that morning. I mean, my relief got there probably about 6:15, and usually I hung around till 7 a.m. or so. But that morning I took off early and went by the Murrah Building up 5th Street. And I looked up at the time and I thought, goodness gracious, I've got hours until I can go in there. So I went and got me a bite to eat at a little Hardee's, or I think it was what it was called then. It's called Carl's Jr. now there. But nonetheless, and I went home and started working in the yard. And I'm kind of glad I did because of what happened later on that day. But I'll never forget, you know, I was sitting there, not in front of the Murray Building. You couldn't park there legally. There was an unloading zone, loading zone only. But I had parked up the street. I remember looking at the sky thinking, my gosh, what a gorgeous day this is. Because we'd had a little bit of rain the week before and a little bit of wind. And, you know, and I was just really amped up, ready to use my new chainsaw and my weed eater and, like I said, the lawnmower. And so I went to the new house. And when I got there, I was happy I did because it was gorgeous weather. And people have remarked in a lot of the interviews I've listened to and a lot of the films of how pretty it was that day. It was just a picturesque day, one of the prettiest blue skies, free of chemtrails, mind you, that I've ever seen. And I went out in the yard and just started working right away. And it was peaceful. There was a slight breeze out of the south, blowing to the south. I'm sorry, to the northeast. I mean, just very slight. It was probably 70-ish, 72 degrees, somewhere in there. And I'll never forget, I was trimming a tree. I had just lobbed off a branch and was looking straight up at the sky when I felt the explosions and heard them. And it scared the bejeebies out of me because, I mean, it was so quiet and peaceful, just a little bit of traffic going down the road in front of my home. And it scared me so bad, I went to my knees, and it was almost deafening. It lasted maybe 6 to 8 seconds total. And I know that, you know, I've gone through it a million times in my head, but I'm positive I felt two blasts and heard three. And they were so close together. It was kind of a pop, 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 but much louder. It was loud enough that 10th Street, it's a pretty major throughway, in the city I lived in. I lived in Midwest City at the time, just due east of Oklahoma City. And 10th Street, we were 8.5 miles from the bombing, from the Murr Building, I mean, and traffic actually stopped. Everybody got, I mean, I saw people get out of their cars. I'm standing there with the chainsaw in my hand thinking, what in the hell just happened? I thought, you know, I thought it was a dream until I saw a car stop and people holding their hands in the air saying, what was that? Because it felt like an earthquake, and I mean, it made our ears ring. And that we were that far away. And so I thought, well, man, must have been, you know, an explosion of some sort or whatever. And I didn't pay much mind. Well, 15 minutes later, my bride-to-be pulled up in my driveway honking with her dad driving her car and got out. And they told me, they said, you need to come with us. Oklahoma City downtown has just been eliminated. And they thought a gas main had blown up. Somebody thought it was a nuclear bomb. And, you know, there were all sorts of early ideas. And I didn't know what happened. And so I went to down the street to my future father-in-law's parents' house and saw on TV what had happened and what was unfolding. And I remember looking at my bride-to-be saying, I was just right in front of that building this morning. And so it was a little emotional for me. But, you know, I was new to the fire department at the time. And the last time I'd seen that building, just to describe it for people that have never been to downtown Oklahoma City or had never seen it before, it was I believe it was 9 stories high, if I remember the building, but it was made of the facade on the front was a beautiful red granite. We call Tishomingo granite. It comes from the central southern region of Oklahoma, and they had dark glass across the front. It was really a good-looking building as far as buildings go. It wasn't unattractive at all. And what I saw on TV was nothing like I remembered. I mean, it was hardly recognizable. It was just a shell of what it had been. And as the helicopters were hovering over and smoke was bellowing out, and they didn't know what happened. They just kept saying a gas main or some sort of explosion or whatever. And so I went down there pretty quickly to see what I could do because, you know, I was an active fireman in Oklahoma City. And even though I was new to the force, I thought, you know what, I better report to duty, even though I haven't had any phone calls. And they're not calling for it on the news. And I went down there, and pretty much everybody from the fire department showed up. We had, I believe, 1,000 men in the suppression division of our fire department, pretty good-sized fire department. And most of them showed up, the ones on duty as well as off duty, as well as all the suburbs around Oklahoma City showed up too. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of people showed up, police officers, paramedics, doctors, hospital personnel, even people from Tinker Air Force Base were showing up to lend assistance. And I was turned away pretty quickly and told, you know what, you're going to be on duty tomorrow. You need to relax. You need to rest, and because you're going to be here all day. And so I went home and pretty much was glued to the TV until late that night, got a few hours of sleep, and I was at the station the next morning at about 5:30 a.m. And so, but that's kind of a background of, in a nutshell, of what I felt and heard that day. And I'll never forget about it. Now, before I go into what I saw, I saw in the chat room there's people that don't know a bunch about the Oklahoma City bombing. And so what I'm going to do is share the official story briefly, if that's fine to you.
That'd be fine with me.
Just to kind of show the contradictions and so forth.
Right.
The official story, which kind of, it was very organic. It changed rapidly, and in 1 minute was this, 1 minute was that. But as it stands today, in 2013, almost 18 years later, the official story is there were a bunch of angry white supremacists that were tied to militias in Oklahoma, Kansas, South Dakota, Nebraska. And they were fed up with the federal government, and they thought they were going to strike back at them because of the ATF's snafu at Waco, the Waco massacre that had happened 2 years before on April 19th. It'd be 1993 that happened. And so the official story is they took a large Ryder truck, I believe it was 20, 21 feet long, filled it with drums of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil, maybe 4,000 to 7,000 pounds of it, and they exploded it with a lone wolf assassin named Tim McVeigh, who was the ringleader at 902. The bomb was built with the help of Terry Nichols, who was a kind of a pissed-off farmer from the Midwest who was angry at the government, and because he had lost his farm and families he knew had lost his farm, and 168, 169 people, depends on how you count it, died. And they want you to accept that. And enough time has gone by that as I get out and about and talk to people, and for instance, earlier this year, or maybe it was last year, I had a building inspector. I work in construction and build homes, but I had a building inspector. We got to talking one day, and he goes, "Oh, you're from Oklahoma City?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "What do you do there?" I said, "Oh, I was a fireman." And he goes, "Oh, were you at the bombing?" I said, "Sure was." I said, and I told him just a little bit. And he pretty much just said the official story. And I said, "Well, you know, there's more to that." And he goes, "Well, that's what the investigator said, and that's good enough for me." And I said, "Lord bless you, buddy. But you know what? You're wrong." And I try, and I
showed
him.
Who was this that said that?
This was a building inspector up here in Idaho where I live.
Okay.
And just to give you an illustration of what the standard, American, red-blooded American thinks, they think, "Oh, well, you know what? The government said the official story. That's good enough for me. You know, I have a nice cushy home. I've got a cushy job. I'm okay with it. I trust my government." But, you know, I was a young man when this happened. And like I said, I was 21 years old. I grew up in a typical neocon, kind of Rush Limbaugh kind of family. And what I saw there, it shook everything I believed at that point. And because I lost all faith and trust in my government. I lost trust that they had our best interest in mind. And so that's what I try to do when I talk to people and tell them that, you know what, this is what I saw in one isolated incident in my life. This is what, it's a part of who I am now. And if I'm right on this, which I'm sure I am, I might be right on other things like 9/11, other events that have unfolded in history, maybe the Kennedy assassination, things like that. It helps me to explore some of those things and ideas and say, you know what? Maybe we weren't told the official story on those. Maybe the official story is bunk. And so what I usually do with people is once I tell them the official story and they say, "Oh, yeah, that's what I believe," I tell them the things that I saw. And I've made a list of six things that I saw my first day there. My first full day at the bombing was April 20th. I got to the site, I think it was between 10 and 11 o'clock in the morning. We had set in the station, and one thing that was unusual, and this was odd. I'm going to take an aside here. It's not in my notes, but it popped in my head. You know, during Hurricane Katrina, as soon as that hurricane blew through, they were looting and scooting within minutes. I mean, they were robbing stores and killing each other in no time flat. And like I said before, I was at the busiest fire station in Oklahoma, one of the busiest in the nation. I mean, our record day was 27 calls. I mean, that's a lot of calls. That's more than one an hour. And the thing is that next day we had zero calls. And when I mean zero, I don't mean just my station. I mean the entire city. There was nothing. Everybody was looking at the television, and even the people that were usually committing the crimes and, you know, raping and looting and stealing and murdering and beating each other up, they were sitting at home scared to death of what they were seeing, because they had not been conditioned to this sort of thing yet. And now by the time Katrina has showed up, they're all conditioned to it. They're like, ah, whatever, another, it's a natural disaster or a man-made disaster, whatever. You know what? We've seen, you know, 9/11, Oklahoma City bombing, Waco. Who cares? Let's just go get us some free stuff. That didn't happen. There was not one iota of that. And like I said, there was not even car wrecks. People were taken off work. The interstate by my fire station was almost dead. It was like a zombie apocalypse happened. It was the most unusual thing. I'll never forget when we were driving down Interstate 44, one of the busier interstates that comes up from Wichita Falls and follows old Route 66 for a ways and goes on up to your way up in Indianapolis. And nonetheless, it was dead. When I mean dead, there was no traffic, and it was uncanny. I had never seen it like that. It was like everybody was gone. Nobody was around. And so, but back onto my subject matter here, the first thing that I tell people that I saw, and I've got a photograph of it. I had a friend that I saw the first day of the bombing on April 19th, and he took a lot of photos, and he was one of the fortunate guys that didn't have his camera repossessed by the federal government. There was a lot of guys that did and had it destroyed, including me. And but he was able to get photographs, and one of the photos that he showed me, I'll never forget, that morning he went and got our development April 19th at night, brought him to the fire station, all gave us a copy. He goes, look at this. And it was a little red car in front of Regency Tower. Regency Tower is a high-rise hotel due west of Oklahoma City. And I'm sorry, of Oklahoma City, of the Murrah Building. And in front of this little red car, I believe it was a Ford Fiesta, if I remember right, was this two-ton pickup axle. And it had actually landed on the hood of this car, bounced off, and was laying on the ground. His photo was timestamped at 11:09 a.m. April 19th. That's the timestamp. There was already a red line painted around it, like you see, you know, crime, like a police officer would do for a crime scene. And he was told by an officer that was standing near there, he goes, what's this? And the officer said, it's the axle of the Ryder truck that blew up the building. He was like, okay, cool, whatever. The next day we got to talking about it, and he goes, what is he talking about, Ryder truck? Nobody knew about a Ryder truck. That didn't come out till 2 or 3 days later, that there was a Ryder truck. And then not only that, they didn't track the axle for days. They talked about, I remember seeing a news broadcast like on 2020 or ABC or some channel, and they were going through all this kind of CI detective work, you know, CSI kind of nonsense. And they said, oh, the detectives, the FBI, they're so diligent. They got there. They found a number on the axle. They went to the axle manufacturer, and the axle manufacturer tracked it to Ryder truck. And they went to Ryder truck, and they found a VIN number. It took them days of hard, diligent work. God bless the FBI. They found it, and it took them almost a week. 2 hours after the bombing, they knew it was a Ryder truck. He was told that. The next day, I walked by the very same axle. There was a young ATF guy there with an ATF jacket on, and my officer, who was a kind of a cocky kind of guy, kind of matter of fact, he said, sir, what's that right there? And the guy said, it's an axle. What's it look like? He was kind of, you know, kind of arrogant. And he goes, what's it from? And he goes, that's an axle from the Ryder truck that was used up to blow up the building. That was 24 hours after the bombing. They still had the story. But the point I'm getting at, the official story says that they didn't know it was a Ryder truck until days, maybe a week after the bombing. Now, 18 years later, they've got all sorts of stories concocted. They claim now there was a VIN number actually on the axle. I've been around cars my entire life. I've been tearing down motors. I grew up, you know, kind of on a farm. We had a family farm with a big truck. And I'm telling you, there's no VIN numbers on axles on those things. There's numbers, but there's not VIN numbers on every auto part to the cars. That's nonsense. And so they want you to think now that they knew the day of the bombing that it was there, which they did. But the point is, they've changed their story. Like I said, it's always rapidly evolving. 1 minute's this, 1 minute is that. So that's the first contradiction that I throw at people. The next one, and this one really, really set sorely with me and every other fireman I talked to. we showed up on scene, and we were staged at 5th and Harvey. Harvey was just due west of the Murrah Building, and 5th was the street it actually faced. And they had a staging center there, and we could see the debris pile. We could see the gutted building. We could see debris fluttering around and, you know, falling down. We could see the big rock hanging from the top, the big piece of concrete waving in the breeze. And on the debris pile were Oklahoma City firemen and other rescue workers that the city had allowed in there because it was just, it was a secure site. They had a 6-foot fence around the several blocks out from the Murrah Building, and you had to show an ID. You had to go through 2 checkpoints. They made sure that there was nobody sneaking in. And the reason why is because 2 days later, Geraldo Rivera dressed up like a fireman and did try to sneak in. So, little known fact. But the thing is we were sitting there watching one day, and I saw my officer, and he was a hothead, but I saw him get mad, madder than I've ever seen him get that day. He looked out there and he goes, "Those." I'm not going to repeat what he said, but you can get the idea, a lot of curse words. And he said, "Those friggin' feds are up there stepping where people are still lying, their bodies. And we're trying to recover them, and they're more interested in their damn papers than anything." And that's what they were doing. They were walking around looking at every piece of paper, and if it said FBI, ATF, federal government of any sort, they put it in a bag. And they even told firemen, if you see a piece of paper, you need to pick it up and look at it, and if it has our letterhead on it, up on the top, our insignia, give it to us. Do not read it, or we can prosecute you under the full extent of the law, blah, blah, blah. Give it over. And so that really torqued a lot of people because, I mean, there was no one alive at that point, April 20th. They pulled the last person out, I believe, at 7 o'clock or so, 6 o'clock, April 19th, and it was alive. And so it was a recovery effort at that point. But the point is, it was a massive tomb. And they didn't give a rat's patootie what was going on. They were more interested in their dumb papers. And tell me if I'm going too fast, by the way. I'm just kind of...
No, I think it's a really good pace.
I get super amped up about this. And I'll take a pause real quick and tell you. I don't know if everybody else experiences this in their life. This one event has done this to me. It's an event that at times it makes me very sad, almost to tears when I think about it or when I see a picture of the Murrah Building. But at the same time, it makes me so angry. It pushes me so far that, I mean, I'd probably cold cock an FBI agent if he was standing in front of me when I'm thinking about it. I mean, I really would. And so it just angers me so much because of, you know, and I guess it wouldn't anger me as much if they would come out and say, "Look, guys, here's the true story. We screwed up. Here it is." I'd be like, "You know what? Good on you." Because in my business, whenever I make a mistake on a home and a homeowner comes up and says, "Justin, what in the hell are you thinking here?" I have to say, "I'm an idiot. I'm sorry. I screwed up." I don't sit there and make up some vast conspiracy and say, oh, it was the neighbor down the street or it was this or it was that. I have to fess up. And if the government would just do that, you know what? I would lay down on all this stuff. I'd say, good on you guys. Thanks for fessing up. So, but back on target here. The third thing that I noticed that day, and like I said, I'm in construction now. I grew up in construction. I've been around it my entire life from a young boy until now. I'm 39 years old, and I was pretty much born into construction. It's what I've always been in. And with construction, while I build a lot of very nice things from nothing to something, there's times I have to deconstruct things. I've seen a lot of demolition. I participated in a lot of demolition. And the thing about demolition I've always noticed is always, no matter how chaotic it looks, no matter how random it looks, there is always a purpose. You can always look at it and see a pattern. You can always look at it and say, wow, you started here, finished here. And you can see things throughout. The Oklahoma City bombing was no different. It blew up the Murrah Building. It was exploded. And what I saw walking into there, I walked, we had to park about 3 or 4 blocks straight northwest of the building and walk up. And the debris that I saw was unbelievable. North and east and west of the building, it was just a huge debris debris field, rock, papers, insulation, drywall, computer parts, you name it. It was like a tornado had gone through and just blended everything together. It was amazing, the carnage. But I did go to the backside of the Murrah building. There was hardly anything there. In fact, the windows on the courthouse, most of them were still intact. The windows on the back of the Oklahoma City, or the Murrah building, still intact. They were there. And the thing that's amazing to me is I've told this to people and they say, well, you know, the Murrah building did act as a shield. And I'll tell them, okay, let's go with that. I'll tell them, you know, the Ryder truck supposedly pulled within 15 feet of the front door of the Murrah building. 15 feet. I think it was further than that because the sidewalk was where they're further than that, you know, from the street to the front door. But let's go with 15 feet. If it really happened that way, and I'm going to talk about ampho bombs in a little bit later on in this broadcast, but the way ampho bombs work, they spread out from one central location, the epicenter, and they spread out. Why weren't the back of the windows blown out on the Murrah building? Why weren't windows on the federal courthouse behind the Murrah building on 4th Street blown out? Why was there hardly any debris on 4th Street? Why did it almost terminate on each side, Harvey Street and I can't remember the name of the other street to the other side of the Murrah building. I think it's Robinson. There was nothing hardly there at all. Past four, and like I said, once you got in between 4th and 5th Street, it was just gone. And so the Murrah building couldn't have acted as that big a shield. If it was a real ampho bomb that blew up in front or any kind of bomb, I don't care what it was, it would have blown stuff still that away, but it didn't. It blew stuff instead blocks away. And like I said, I'll talk about that in a little bit. And one of the things that I'll mention is there was debris from within the Murrah building that went blocks north. How does a bomb that is supposed to blow up going south spread debris blocks north? It doesn't happen. I mean, we live in a world that has order. We live in, you know, we have a set of constraints that physics are confined by, and that goes against everything that everybody knows. You know, a bomb doesn't blow up one way and send debris another way. It does not happen. And so that was a big one for me to see all that. And one of the other things that I'll mention too, and I'll mention more of this when I go through the ampho bomb, going with the demolition thing, I've seen some pretty big structures demolished. Whenever they're demolished, you can tell which way they fall. When, you know, whether a fire caused it, whether it was man-made, with an excavator or a jackhammer, whatever, even a bomb, you can still see which way it falls. Most of the columns that were, well, not most, every column that was eliminated in the Murrah building fell straight down. And not only that, there was a lintel or a header. It was a huge concrete beam across the very front of the building on the first floor that held up all, it was a kind of a truss that held up all the other floors above it. It fell down and rolled towards where the truck bomb would have been. Now, I'm not an expert here, but I think if a bomb goes off, it's going to blow that sucker back. It didn't. It came forward. So, like I said, I'm going to cover that more in depth in a minute, just to give you a brief overview of that. The next point, I don't really know where to take this, honestly. I've told people this.
Maybe it was like a magic bomb, kind of similar to the magic bullet from JFK.
I guess so. You know, what is up is now down, and down is up. I guess that's the way this thing worked.
Could be.
It's, you know, reverse physics all of a sudden in Oklahoma City. You know, maybe the Earth's gravitation was off its axis that day. You know, Saturn was aligned with Venus. So, the next point I'm going to cover, this is weird. This is going to sound really weird. And by the way, I've been asked this to cover the weird stuff. I've been asked before, did you see any alien ships the day of the bombing? Well, hell no, I didn't see any alien ships. I didn't see gray men or lizard people walking around. This is real stuff I saw. And the next point, I saw this, and this was just, I still don't know what to do with this because I've never heard a single person ever talk about this. And I've got a picture of this. I mean, I've got a picture of my portfolio. But there was a building just northwest of the Murrah building, right across 5th Street from it, called the Water Resource Building. And it's where the water department for Oklahoma County and Oklahoma City. And when I got there, like I said, we were staged right across the street from this. We sat there for a couple of hours that morning, I mean, maybe like 3 or 4 hours, and hobnobbed with the other guys waiting to be called to participate. And one of the guys I was talking to, we got to notice, and about 75, maybe 80 feet from us, at the front of the building, there was a guy up on a little man lift, little you know, like a genie lift that goes up and down. And he was spray painting orange circles all over. These circles were between 3 and 5 inches in diameter. And we're like, what in the world? I mean, the building looked like a dadgum Dalmatian by the time it was done, an orange Dalmatian. And so we got closer and almost up to the building, and we saw that the entire front of this building, and it wasn't big, it was maybe, I'm going to guess, 20 feet high, but maybe 35, 40 feet wide, this front. But the entire front was covered with 3 to 4 inch black sheetrock screws. And like I said, I grew up in construction, so I knew what they were. And they had been what I call ninja starred in there. It looked like they had just been blown in there. Some were head first, some tip first, sideways, angled. There was no pattern whatsoever. It was just totally random. And we asked him, we said, what are these? And he, his story, he looked at us and he had an FBI jacket on, or shirt, I mean, not a jacket. He had a shirt on that said FBI. And he said this was shrapnel that was in the bomb, or the truck meant to injure more people. Well, I've done some digging over the years, and I have tried my darndest to find any one person injured out of the 700 and some odd injured in the Oklahoma City bombing, not counting the ones dead, but just the ones that were walking and injured and survived. And none of them ever were injured by a flying screw. Not one. And not only that, but this was the only building that there were any screws on. There were none on the Murrah building. There were none on the Journal Record building, none on the YMCA, none on the Regency Tower, none on the church, nothing. There were none anywhere. And so, and like I said, I mean, I've talked to other firemen about it. I've talked to hospital staff I knew. I've talked to, I knew a lot of paramedics that were with the ambulance service in Oklahoma City. And none of them knows a thing about it. They're like, screws, what in the world are you talking about? Are you been drinking again? And I tell them, oh, never mind. Yeah, it's a long story. You know, you don't want to know. But to this day, I still don't know if they were planted there maybe. And that was a possible theory the feds were using, or an angle they were going to use in the bombing, or what it was. But it just, it's one of those anomalies that I don't think they were exploded out of the bomb. I really don't, because it was isolated in one building. But why were they there? I don't know. Just, it was weird.
And this was the water utility building?
The water resource building.
Water resource building.
Yeah. And you can look around. They've released a few photographs of the Oklahoma City bombing online. And I found a couple of years ago that you could see actually the circles on the front of this building. And it says Oklahoma Water Resource Board right there on the front, or resource building on the front of the building. And underneath, you can see all these orange circles. But again, my best guess is it was an angle the feds were going to work, and it didn't pan out for whatever reason. Because here later on, we'll learn that that's one thing the Fed does. Whenever they're involved with some false flag operation, they try to cover every base, and they are a bit like an amoeba. They kind of go in every direction at once until they find out what direction they're going to go when they take that one angle, and all the other angles lead to dead ends. And I think this was a dead end angle that they were pursuing for some reason.
Whatever. And you have a photo of the circle and screws? Of the circles
I do.
And screws?
Yeah, I do. I do. I don't know if I have it online or not. I'd have to look and see, but I could actually get that to you. I'd find it first, but I do have a photo of it.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
So, just, and like I said, it's a minor thing, but yeah, still it's interesting.
Yeah, it's
so, the fifth point I'll go through, and this is the biggest one of all. This is one when I look back, I think, you know what? You know, as you get older in life, you look back and think of some of the dumb things you've done. As a young man, you think, golly, I wish I would have kept my mouth shut. and I'm thankful I'm still alive. But anyways, I had heard the stories of C4 explosives from other firemen that saw them in the building on the 19th and early the morning of the 20th. I had heard stories that even the news media had reported their disarming bombs, the bomb squads on site. And that was all over the news. All three of the major channels in Oklahoma City were talking about it. They were interviewing people that saw them. I mean, it was a well-known fact. I mean, there were hundreds of people that saw them. I hadn't seen any yet. And, you know, it's not that I was going around looking for them. But, excuse me, the official story that we were told, minus, like I said, that little axle thing I mentioned a minute ago, we were told that C4 explosive brought it down. And it was a bunch of Muslim terrorists trying to incite some sort of holy jihad against Americans, is what we were told. And so, if I would have seen plastic explosives like the other firemen, no big deal. That's what we were told happened. And so, by golly, that's what it took to bring it down in our minds. Well, my first full shift there on the 20th, after, like I said, sitting hours in the staging area, my officer found a position in the logistics and supply division, which was across the street, kind of northwest a little bit, next to the Journal Record building. I can't remember. It was a parking garage there. And we had every supply you can imagine, from shovels to gloves to you name it. And so what I would do for a couple hours, we would truck back and forth these supplies back and forth. And I got to talk to a lot of firemen that talked about explosives and seeing things and this and that and complaining about the feds. But so after a couple hours of that, I was recruited by the chief for Oklahoma City of the medical division. He came to my officer and said, "Hey, I need a volunteer to come man a decontamination booth. We need to decontaminate guys coming out of the building. They're going to have flesh on them, blood on them, body parts and so forth, and we need to get that off of them." So I went, you know, I was excited about it, and I went there. It was staged on Robinson Street, right between 4th and 5th, across from the entrance to the parking garage to the Murrah building. And I did see a lot of guys, and there was a lot of guys came out with, you know, a little bit of flesh here and there on them and blood and stuff. And so I had to decontaminate a lot of them. Well, we were seeing so many guys come through that the chief told me, he said, "I've already set up another booth on the southwest corner. It'd be 4th and Harvey Street. We're going to start channeling guys over there." But he told me, he said, they have the parking garage cordoned off at the moment. They did. They had barricades there, and there were federal agents in there. And he said, "We've got to wait till they get it cleared." They said they'd have it cleared in maybe 30 minutes to an hour, and then we'll have guys go over there. But he said, "Here," and he gave me a radio. He gave me all the supplies I needed and a notebook to take names of people and what they'd if their gloves got soiled or whatever, their jackets, whatever got soiled, so we could know where it went. And so he told me, he said, "Go over there." And I told him, and it was already dark at this point. I said, "Well, do you want me to go up 4th Street or through the garage?" And we both knew 4th Street was just a nightmare. There wasn't hardly any debris, but there were all these big tubes for fresh air into the building, because the air in the building wasn't real. It was stagnant. You know, it was dusty and just didn't smell real good. And so they were pumping fresh air in there. Not only that, they had power lines coming down there. And when I mean power lines, I'm talking 2 and 3 inches across some of these feeder cables for power, for the generator lights and stuff and all the equipment. And not only that, but to help make sure there was plenty of power in the Murrah building, they had shut down the lights on 4th Street so it was dark. It was like, me and him both looked at each other and said, "Yeah, well, you're going to break a leg. You try to walk down there." So he told me, he goes, "Go ahead and go to the parking garage. Yeah, who cares what the federal agents say?" And so I get to walking through there. You know, I walked around the barricade, and I think it was about, I'm going to guess the Murrah building was maybe 400 feet, this garage, from start to finish. And I'm walking through it. I'm maybe a quarter or a third of the way through it. And I could see federal agents to my left, which would be towards the Murrah building, as I'm in this kind of sunken garage. It's kind of below grade. It's below the level of the street. And I see them messing around, and I'm like, "Oh, no big deal." And as I get closer, I notice that they're messing around with C4 and what I presumed to be C4 at the time. I, you know, had never seen it in my life other than, you know, on television shows and such. And, you know, in wires, and they were taking these straps and this plastic stuff off these columns, concrete columns, and putting it in the back of this Suburban into cases and stuff. And there were several of them. And I saw a couple of FBI jackets, a few ATF, and one guy that I know had a U.S. Marshal jacket. And I don't know why in the world he was there, or if he even was a U.S. Marshal, but he had a jacket nonetheless. And as I got closer to them, because I was walking up to them, but I had to pass them, and I got within probably 25 feet of them. And as I was getting close to them, the guy with the U.S. Marshal jacket came out to me and said, "What are you doing? Where are you going? Who are you?" and so forth. And, you know, and wanted to know everything about me right then and there. And I thought, you know, I was tired, first of all. And I was a little smart mouth when I was younger, worse than I am now. And I remember telling him, I said, "You know, it's pretty obvious of who I work for," because I was wearing my full protective fire bunker gear like I go into a fire. I was wearing my helmet. I had my name tag on the front of my jacket. I had a flashlight in my thing, one pocket, and walkie-talkie. excuse me, in another, and I had a bag that said Oklahoma City Fire Department on it. I was carrying with all sorts of medical gear and stuff. And I'm like, it's pretty obvious who I'm with. Yeah. And I said, not only that, we have a secure perimeter. You know, I'm not a fraud. Okay. You can talk to my chief. He's standing back there. And he actually was. I looked back and you could see him walking around. I said, go talk to him. And he goes, no, I don't need to talk to him. And then he started to press me further. And I said, you know, oh no, he told me, he goes, you know, I can arrest you right here on the spot and I can detain you, indefinitely. If you keep getting lippy with me. I said, you know, I'm not getting lippy with you. You know, and I was trying to explain it to him where, what I was doing, where I was going, what I've been doing for several hours. And then I said something. I said, you know, I said, I don't know if you can arrest me or not, but I said, I do know that my fire chief, the chief of the Oklahoma City Fire Department at the time, Gary Mars, I said, he is the incident commander. He wasn't there that night. He passed command to one of his inferiors, but he still, we were in charge of the scene, and he laughed. And kind of smirked at me, this federal agent, and he goes, or whoever he was, and he said, hey, he goes, you guys just think you're in charge. And I knew right then and there, I thought, you know what, you're full of crud. Because we had already been told by my district chief at the fire station that morning that there was a huge wrestling match between the FBI and the Oklahoma City Fire Department. Because the FBI showed up and they wanted to be in command because it's a federal building. And according to the protocol for incident command on an emergency, when you set it up, the first responder there that sets up incident command, the way it works, they are in charge of the scene until they decide when to relinquish it and pass it to somebody else. And they have to pass it to someone of equal value or higher value in their eyes. And our chief refused to pass. He said, we can handle this. We are a large department. We're very well skilled in triage, and we're skilled in extrication and things like that and emergencies. We can handle it. If you guys want to be our little go-to boys, FBI and helpers, more power to you. And the FBI and him wrestled back and forth, and finally the FBI said, you know, screw you, and kind of gave up, you know, pursuit of that. But, you know, and I'm sitting there thinking about that in the back of my mind. This guy's telling me that he's in charge, and I thought, what in the world kind of yay, who are you? But, you know, we exchange a few more words, and finally, I guess he thought, you know what, this kid, this is either a kid, I'm tired of jacking with him, or I want to go home, or this kid's a moron, or whatever. But he goes, I'll tell you what, I'll let you go on to your station so you don't get in trouble with your superior. And, but he goes, I want you to walk straight. And I had about 150, 200 more feet to go in the garage. And he goes, I want you to keep walking straight. Don't look left. Don't look right. Keep walking straight and get there. And so I thought, oh my gosh, this guy, and for some reason I got a little startled. I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy's going to, you know, jack me, arrest me, shoot me or something. You know, I didn't know. And so I kind of scuttled out of there as quick as I could and got to my post. And where my post was, this little station, I was all alone there for, you know, like I said, every bit of an hour until they cleared the parking garage of the feds. But what they did is I could see them down in there, their Suburbans. They had a couple of black Suburbans. You know, late, I guess it'd be mid-90s Suburbans, 93, 94 Suburbans in there. And I could see the hoods of them and kind of the fenders. And once in a while, I'd catch a little movement in there. But I couldn't see what they were doing. And I didn't really even care because I thought, you know what? They're doing their job. They're taking care of the explosives. I didn't know. And so the point is a little bit later, you know, like I said, after I've been there about an hour, they moved the barricade and three of them pulled out. I think it was three. It could have been four of the SUVs pulled out. And they put the barricade to the side, and firemen started to trickle out after that and decontaminated a few of them. And finally, I was relieved, and I walked back through there, and there was no sign of a Fed one. And so, and I told my other fireman buddies that, and they're like, dude, I don't know if I'd ever tell anybody that story. When I got back to the station, they said, you may end up in a hole somewhere. And so I it was years before I started telling that story. It was a good, gosh, 13 years after the bombing before I finally started telling people that, because I was a little scared that, you know, with things I'll talk about in here in a little bit, of that I might end up, you know, DOA somewhere. But the last thing that I saw that night, and I'll try to be brief on this, I'm kind of dragging out a little bit, but that really just, it was laughable, but it kind of irked me off at the same time. It was about 3 or 4 in the morning, and if you remember the official story, the Ryder truck parked right in front of the front doors of the Murrah building. And when it exploded, it made a crater. And the feds claimed the crater is anywhere from 32 to 45 feet across and 7 to 9 feet deep. They've got this massive, I mean, it's like a pond that they have drawn up. I saw the crater. I walked right by it. it was maybe 13 to 16 feet across, maybe 4 to 5 feet deep, maybe, I mean, it could have been 5.5 feet deep. It wasn't that big. And like I said, growing up in construction and also having a family farm, I'd seen a lot of ponds pushed out. It was very small. It wasn't near as big as what the feds later claimed it was. And we'll talk about why there's a discrepancy in a minute. But we were sitting there in front. I was taking a breather because we'd been there, like I said, for over 12 hours at that point. And I worked until 7 a.m. that morning. I mean, I've never worked so hard so long at night on something. But we were taking a break between 3 and 4. And we were watching this large front-end loader, you know, piece of equipment, tractor with about a 3 to 5 yard bucket on the front of it. And he was moving debris from around the crater and loading up into these demolition trucks who were hauling the debris off. I don't know where they were hauling it. I presume the dump. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But they were hauling it off. And we started noticing these gravel trucks started coming in from a local they were a private-owned company, not fed. But these gravel trucks had 30-yard beds on them. They, you know, were a long truck, equivalent of two dump trucks, and they'd tilt up in the air and dump their gravel. And there was maybe 10 or 12 of them showed up that we could see staged going up Fifth Street. They were backing in there. And nonetheless, pretty soon we saw a guy with a blue helmet. He motioned for him to start bringing him in, and I was later told he was a federal engineer, worked for the federal government. And it come over from Tinker Air Force Base, and there were several of them there, dressed in their jumpsuits with their helmets on. You could tell they were, you know, construction engineers of some variety. And nonetheless, they started dumping it in. Now, growing up around construction, there's one thing I know, especially on a commercial job site, especially where you have big equipment moving through. You never just dump a whole lot of gravel or dirt in a hole. That's stupid. You have what's called air voids in there, and you have to compact it. Like up here in North Idaho where I live, if we do that and it's a road there, we have to have a compaction test. We have to have a certified official on site to compaction test it every 1 foot of fill. That means we put in a foot of fill, we compact it, it's got to compact within 97% of what it should be compacted for commercial or 95% for residential. They weren't doing any of that. They were doing none of that. They were just dumping in a hole and spreading it out with this big tractor, which a big tractor, even though it was a big tractor, probably weighed 60,000 pounds, still it doesn't compact. It might compact 4 inches deep. And so they weren't getting compaction. And they were in such a hurry to fill this crazy hole. And I'll talk about that why that in a minute. But one of the last trucks to dump, it was probably the 8th or 9th truck maybe, could have been later than that, but he backed over where they had already filled the gravel, and he was dumping his gravel in there, and we saw as he was going up, his truck looked like it shook from left to right, and one of the guys that I was with said, look at that, look. And we thought maybe because if you take a dump truck up too fast sometimes and you give it a lot of throttle, it'll kind of rock the truck if it's on unsteady ground, but he wasn't. We heard the idle, and he was idling up just real slow. But then all of a sudden, when his truck bed got straight up in the air, and like I said, it's a full-size semi, or small semi-truck bed, for gravel, got straight up in the air, it fell over on the driver's side. And what gravel was still in the truck dumped out, made a huge debris cloud, you know, not huge, but still it made it a small debris cloud of dust. And we were close enough, we actually felt a small blast of wind where we were sitting, because we were sitting maybe 300 feet from it, 250 feet from it, or somewhere in there. And nonetheless, the guy, and we were the first ones to run over there because we thought someone had been killed, because the engineers were right next to the truck. And they had barely, by the skin of their teeth, got out of the way from this thing falling over. And the driver, we thought, may be hurt, but he was real shaken, but he got out of the truck. And nonetheless, the engineer at that point decided, you know what? If that truck is going to tip over here, the cranes that we'll bring in later and the heavy equipment to clean this up, they're going to tip over too. And so we watched, and they pulled almost every rock of gravel out of that hole. They got a skid steer there and got in the hole, and they just pushed it all out. And they brought a compactor in, you know, a steamroller is that they call it. And they brought the roller compactor in, and they started putting it in there in small lifts and did it the way it was supposed to be done. Now, the significance of this, I know people are probably thinking, why am I talking about filling a hole? Here's the significance. The FBI and the federal government claims this hole is a lot bigger than it really was. Why? Because a small crater means a small bomb. A small bomb means it wouldn't blow up the building. The Fed knows they need a humongous bomb to blow up that building from the outside. If the bomb set outside the building and wasn't inside, they have to have a large bomb. And so they need a big crater for that. Well, if they cover up the crater and claim that it was this size, nobody knows, according to them. They're kind of like the little kid sweeping the crumbs under the carpet, and, you know, mom won't know about that. She doesn't see it until she finds it later. But the thing is, too, is police. I knew several police officers in Oklahoma City. I had grown up in a law enforcement family. I had several family members in law enforcement, and they were ticked. They thought, you know, this is the stupidest thing. I remember hearing some family members of mine talking. They said, the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. They went and filled that hole up in the middle of the night, April the 20th, or I guess April 21st now, because it's 3 to 4 a.m., but still, less than 2 days after the bombing, they had never investigated the hole thoroughly. One of their biggest pieces of investigation or evidence, gone. It's eliminated. And that's the way the feds do it. They do shoddy work and make broad assumptions in the middle of everything, and they don't care. And so when I tell people that, it starts getting their wheels to spin and thinking, you know what? Maybe there's something more to the Oklahoma City bombing. Maybe you know, these stories I'm hearing are right, because I know I've talked to people, you know, that I run onto. You know, we'll get to talking about 9/11 and, you know, whether it's a false flag or not, or whether the planes brought it down or whatever. And I've had people tell me, you know what, I have full faith in the government. I believe the planes brought it down. But then when I tell them my Oklahoma City bombing story, and they're able to talk to me and see my eyes and how serious I am, and hear the inflection of my voice and know that, you know what, I'm not full of it. And I can throw down pictures that back up what I'm saying, and stories and videos that also support what I'm saying of other eyewitnesses. They look at me and say, you know what, this means that 9/11 could have been a false flag too. And I say, bingo, it really does mean that. And it also means that there may be other false flags headed our way. And I believe there are someday. I don't know when or where, but I believe that the government, and I'll talk about this in a little bit, but I believe this was kind of a training ground for the government, was the Oklahoma City bombing. They were trying to get all their little ducks in a row to see if they could pull off something of this magnitude. And they did. It was sloppy, but they did.
Go ahead. You still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I was going to say, with false flag operations and big events like this, whether it's JFK or 911, you always have conflicting eyewitness accounts. And the Warren Commission never reported on the several witnesses who said they heard shots from the grassy knoll. The 911 Commission report never reported on the people that claimed to hear explosions in one of the towers from the basement. What were some conflicting eyewitness reports regarding the OKC bombing?
There was a ton of them, and I don't have time to go through all of them tonight. I encourage people that want to learn more. I'm going to list some resources at the end of this broadcast that they can consult that will fill them in a lot more than I have. But one thing you mentioned before I go through these, like the Warren Commission, the commission that was in charge of the Oklahoma City bombing report, there were a lot of people that were told they could testify, but if their story so much as even one little bit doubted the official story, they weren't allowed to have their testimony in court. And they were told, well, we thank you for your time. There were even people, because the court case where Timothy McVeigh was held in Denver, Colorado, which was actually illegal. They were supposed to hold it in the district that happened, the federal district, which would have been Dallas or Oklahoma City or maybe Kansas City. I don't know if it would extend that far, but the point is, there were people that traveled to Denver to tell their story. They were told, hey, you're going to testify. They get there, and the federal prosecutors say, I'm sorry, we don't need your story. We've already got enough of that nonsense. And here's some of the stuff, and I'm not going to give names to people. I can't remember all their names. I've met several people that were witnesses and seen things and talked to them and heard their stories, and most of them are like me. They're just normal people that hold jobs, that have families, they are out to gain nothing. They want no recognition. They want no statues after themselves. They just want to be heard. They just want to say, you know what, the government story is bullcrap, and here is what I say. And that's all they want. And that's kind of what I want. I don't want any recognition. I want nothing. I just want people to say, you know what, this guy saw things that contradict the official story. But here's some of the things. There are numerous, and when I mean numerous, I'm talking dozens of people the morning of the bombing that saw Timothy McVeigh with between one and three men, usually the average is two, on April 19th patrolling around downtown Oklahoma City or the days before. Now, like I said earlier in the broadcast, I was right in front of the Murrah Building the day of the explosion. Before it was exploded, I didn't see anybody. I was too focused on, hey, it's a good-looking day, and I got a new chainsaw here in the truck with me. That's I was kind of focused on that. So I wish I could have seen Tim McVeigh and guys walking around, but unfortunately I didn't. I wish I would have paid better attention. But there were numerous people that saw that. Not one of them was allowed to testify in Tim McVeigh's trial. Not one of them. Only the people that changed their story and said, oh, we saw Tim McVeigh by themselves were allowed to testify. The second thing, the Oklahoma City Bomb Squad, they had a large bomb disposal truck. It was, I believe, a Chevy truck, a crew cab with a little bomb trailer they'd pull around. I had seen it several times because growing up in law enforcement, we used to go out to the county gun range and shoot guns all the time, and I'd seen the bomb truck sitting there, so I knew what it looked like. But it was reported seen all over around the Murrah Building that morning. It was reported seen on Robinson Street, on Harvey Street. It was even reported on 5th Street right about – I think it's 8 blocks, maybe it's 7 blocks due west of the Murrah Building was the Oklahoma City Fire Department station number one. It was a big fire station, our central headquarters. Right across the street from them, they reported seeing the bomb truck, the bomb disposal squad, about 7:30 or 8 o'clock that morning. And one of the guys wrote it in the logbook that day because every fire station has a logbook. And the logbook, all it does is keep track of the calls for court, you know, pending court cases, you know, if someone tries to sue and they say, hey, you didn't respond or whatever, you know what, we have it in a logbook, we did this, this, and this. But you're also supposed to write down the logbook anything suspicious, anything that you that's kind of out of the normal. It was out of the normal to see the bomb squad across the street, so someone wrote it in there. Supposedly, the page ended up missing, though. I knew people that were at that station that day that were some of the first firemen on scene that saw the bomb truck, and they know it was written in the book, but that page is gone. Vanished, you know, kind of like the magic bullet, you know, in the JFK assassination, just you know, things disappear in the middle of the night. A big one, and this was just remarkable. I've talked to a few people that were in the building when it exploded, and every one of them tells the same story. Not one of them ever conflicts with this. They all felt some small explosions. Most of them felt the floor lift up and go down. It felt like an earthquake, they described, that they didn't even hardly hear the explosions. It was more of a light rumbling they heard and felt. But they heard, like I said, they felt the floor lift up, come down, and not fall, but just come back to where it was and rest. And then they heard the loud boom out front. And it was a loud boom. And that's kind of what I heard 8.5 miles away, was I heard a low grumble followed by a humongous explosion that made my ears ring, and then a little bit of grumbling like distant rolling thunder kind of taper off. And it was like it was just an unusual sound. I actually had a cousin of mine that was in the General Record Building right across 5th Street from the Murrah Building, and I remember him telling me about it. He felt the same thing. He felt what he thought was an earthquake. He, you know, his desk started rattling a little bit, and he wasn't, like I said, in the Murrah Building. He was across the street from it. He could look out his window and see the Murrah Building. And he felt a little bit of rumbling going on right there. And so he hid under his desk thinking it was an earthquake. And he said the lights kind of flickered in the there were fluorescent lights, but they kind of flickered in his office. And then he felt the boom. And the boom actually knocked him and other people in the room kind of just temporarily just gave him shell shock. And so they didn't know what was going on because, I mean, they couldn't hear a thing and they didn't know where they were disoriented. They thought the world had ended. And so, but there's a lot of stories like that. Not one of those people was ever allowed to testify. Because why? Because they felt stuff before the bomb went off, before the supposed Ryder truck went off. Another huge, and this is a major one right here. The offices of the FBI and the ATF, and I believe, I'm trying to think of what the GSA, that's who it was. They were in the Murrah Building. I think there may have been a few other government agencies there that were federal that had some offices there. They were all cleared out the day of the 19th. Not a soul was there. Now, they took so much heat for that. That was even on national news. That made national news. People, you know, like Diane Sawyer, and I remember Connie Chung, if you guys remember who Connie Chung was. I actually saw her in Oklahoma City on the 22nd or 24th of April. I can't remember what day it was, but she was wanting to interview firemen, and she asked me and other guys, and we said no and kept walking. But I remember she said it on national news. She said she was asking, why were the government offices cleared out? Why was no one there? Well, the ATF took so much heat for it. They had two of their members that were stationed there that office there come forward and say, oh, we were there. And not only that, but we're heroes, and we were severely injured. One of them told this heroic story of how his elevator had free fallen five or six stories, and how he had pried his way like He-Man out of this elevator, and how he had saved people, and his arm was broken, and all this other nonsense. We have photos of him, believe it or not, April 19th, talking, and he has not a lick of damage on him. He's at the Murrah building, on the debris, talking to other ATF guys, and there's nothing wrong with him. Not only that, but the elevator company that was called in the day of the bombing, they confirmed that I think there was three, maybe four elevators in the Murrah building. I can't remember how many right now, but they confirmed that not one of the elevators hit freefall, not one of them. And not only that, there were some people trapped in the elevator for maybe 2 hours, and it took some of our firemen in combination with the elevator company and two sets of the jaws of life to pry the elevator doors open. And so this ATF guy somehow, like I said, found He-Man strength to pry his butt out of there, but it took two jaws of life to pry open another elevator. And so you have them coming up these wild stories that, oh, we were there. And whenever they were brought to the attention of these ATF guys, they started getting pissy. And I'll mention some of the pissiness here in a little bit. It's tragic what happened. But this is, in my mind, probably one of the biggest signs of a false flag. If the government had our best interest in mind, if everything that happened there at Oklahoma City at the Murrah building was exactly the way they said it, they should release every videotape from all the closed-circuit television of the Murrah building and all the businesses up and down 5th Street and Robinson and Harvey Street and all around. They should release them, but they haven't. They came through there on the 19th, within minutes of the bombing, confiscated every videotape. It was before the digital age, mind you, and so we couldn't they weren't instantly uploaded online. And nonetheless, they confiscated all the hard copy tapes, and they've never released them. I remember a few years back, they released one, and all it shows is a Ryder truck kind of drive by. And you're like, wow, you know, it's kind of like taking a sight here.
It's like that Pentagon. There were several cameras around the Pentagon during 911, and they confiscated all the gas station and hotel cameras that would have been able to see in a huge 757 airliner crash into the Pentagon. But the only thing they released is some little tiny blurb flying by really quickly, and then some little explosion, which is not definitive at all.
Yeah, and that's the same thing that the Ryder truck film. And a friend of mine commented, and this is pretty funny actually. He goes, "The Ryder truck tape they released is kind of like every tape of Bigfoot I've ever seen. You can't tell a damn thing about it other than there's a blur that goes by."
Yeah, and we're still waiting on the video footage from Sandy Hook, aren't we?
Exactly. There's nothing. And you know, there's videotapes everywhere. If I was to go, you know, commit a crime tonight, rob a bank or something, they'd have my face on the nightly news tonight with all sorts of video feeds and of my car driving away and everything. But yeah. In Oklahoma City and kills 168 people with a bomb. It was the biggest terrorist operation of its time when it happened. And all they have is one little blurry tape. And then not only that, but all the tapes, I think there's, if I remember right, there's 300 hours worth of videotape is the quote, I think, from all the security cameras around, total combined. It's all disappeared.
Well, Justin, you don't understand. It's a national emergency, so we can't give you those. Yeah, it's emergency. They always appeal to emergency and national security to justify keeping evidence. Like the 12 hours of interrogation that they did on Oswald. They actually interrogated him for 12 hours. They had records, and they destroyed the records. That would have been helpful.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the same thing as this. It's like you mentioned with the JFK stuff. If you ever investigate that, they'll say, oh, yeah, we had videotape of it, but it got lost. And I'm thinking, you careless boobs, how does something like this get lost?
Yeah.
One of the biggest stories of all time, and we can't find it, you know what? But what's funny is, when you get outside Oklahoma City, people that were in Oklahoma City at the time, that even if they didn't see what happened down there, even if they didn't go to the scene until later on or to the memorial or whatever, they usually knew someone was there. A lot of people knew. I mean, I knew dozens of people that were there. And so that saw it happen, that were first responders and so forth. And everybody just believes what I'm talking about. But when you go to other states and other cities, other locations in the country, that and more removed, that's when you get people say, you know what, you know, those people in Oklahoma City, they didn't really know what they're talking about. The government's right about their story. But like I said, go to Oklahoma City. That's not the case. I mean, there's people that are still really ticked off there that want to know answers. But some other things. I'll mention two other things, and then I'm going to get into info bombs a little bit. The original news report, and if everybody will remember this that saw it on TV, there was 3 to 4 Middle Eastern men they were looking for. They said these are the people. There was even one news broadcast that showed kind of some artist sketch of them. Our district chief I was in what's called the 605 district in Oklahoma City, and our 605 chief came by that morning. It was his acting chief. It wasn't really him, but aside from that, he told us, he goes, yeah, I just left the chief debriefing meeting, and they told us they're looking for 4 Middle Eastern men. And he goes, I can't remember their names. He goes, it was something Sahib is what he told us. He was kind of a simple redneck like me. He couldn't remember it, and pronounce the names. But he said they mentioned names, and they showed actual photographs of the meeting because they had some federal agents at the chief's meeting that morning. But guess what? A few days, I think it was 2.5 or 3 days into the bombing, that they came up with this idea that there was a crazed white supremacist named Tim McVeigh that held a grudge against the government. He's responsible. All of a sudden, all the jihad terrorists, they're gone, disappeared. And you know, the best I can tell, it wasn't the right time for them. They had to wait till 9/11 to have them come out. Their time wasn't ready yet. So, right. But the last thing, and this is another personal thing.
And by the way, we do know it was a bunch of ragheads because they were able to find a intact ID of one of the guys in the midst of, you know, thousands of yards of fine dust and pulverized beams and stuff.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Isn't it amazing? They can lose hundreds and thousands of hours of video footage of 9/11, but they can find a stinking ID that flew out of a 747 that exploded.
They found it.
Miraculous. I mean, come on. They deserve the Nobel Prize.
Hey, government said so.
Yeah. But this is a big one, and I've got a little personal story for this, too. It's when I really think about the Oklahoma City bombing, it's amazing sometimes. Every year I reflect on it about this time in April. I'll usually, you know, it's kind of a somber day for me, April 19th, and I'll think about it. And like I said, I've got so many connections to Oklahoma City, and you know, my family had roots there, and all these little, you know, kind of, that's like a rose bush. It's kind of spreads out how it's connected to me, kind of a vine. But one day I was, it was right after they had imploded the building. They imploded it with less than 200 pounds of explosives, strategically placed, believe it or not, about a month after the bomb took the bombing. And they started hauling the debris away for about another month. It took them almost to haul the debris away. And they filled it to a landfill called the East Oak Landfill. It's east of Oklahoma City. And the landfill actually sits on land that I grew up on. My great-grandfather bought in the 20s. And when he died in 1979, my great-grandmother, who was full-blood Swedish lady, sweet lady, she sold it to a family friend that promised he was going to preserve it the way it was. Well, within 2 weeks, he had it sold to the landfill company, and he had a very kosher last name. I'll just leave it at that. But he had sold it quickly and broke my grandmother's heart, and she lived another 15 years after that. But that was one of her greatest regrets in life, was selling the land to them because it turned into a landfill. But at that landfill, I was taking some shingles there one day from a house I was re-roofing, and I had to wait in line. There's all these garbage trucks and so forth, and almost dead center over where our old house had been on Mosley Lane that I'd grown up in as a young boy, there was where is where to this day all the Oklahoma City bombing, I mean the Murrah Building sits, all the debris, every ounce of it sits there. And they had a road going in on top of the landfill, and if you've ever been to a landfill, they get pretty high. They're like a small mountain or hill. And I was waiting in line behind all these other trucks and stuff, and there was a guy in a federal agent outfit. He was FBI, and And then I had seen a sheriff's deputy too. I don't know what he was doing there, but nonetheless, there was a special little barricade he had across, and that was for the trucks for the bombing. They were going down in this bigger hole to drop stuff, and I happened to stop right there by him, and so I started talking to him a little bit. It was a nice day, and nonetheless, I told him, I said, yeah, I was a fireman down there, and he goes, yeah, a lot of people lost their life, and we had, you know, some decent small talk, but then I asked him point blank. I said, why are they just putting the debris here from the building so quickly without, you know, investigating it? I said, don't you think the investigation should have gone longer? And that's when his attitude changed. All of a sudden, he wasn't Mr. Nice Guy. Hey, you know what? A lot of people lost their life. He was, you need to roll up your window and move on. Don't ask questions you don't want all the answers to. Get out of here. I could arrest you. You know, all this other nonsense. I'm like, what the hell? You know, one minute you're a decent guy, next minute you're Captain A-hole. What's going on? And so, but a lot of people had those same questions. Why are they so quick to demolish the building, haul it away as quick as can be? They wouldn't let any investigators come look at it. None from the county, none from the state, none from the city of Oklahoma City, nobody. The federal government said, we got it, guys. And anytime the federal government tells you, we got it, guys, that's when you need to watch out. So, but I'd like to talk a little bit about info bombs if you have time, and a few other things, some of the mysterious deaths surrounding the Oklahoma City bombing if we have time.
Yeah, it sounds great. I'm not even sure I've heard of the term AMFO bomb, A-M-F-O.
AMFO, it stands for ammonium fertilizer bomb. I don't, you know, the O, I'm trying to think what it stands for. It's ammonium nitrate and fertilizer bomb is what it is. And I'm not a bomb expert. You know, I'm just a redneck, okay? I'm a carpenter by trade. I was a fireman for 7 years. But at the same time, growing up on a farm, I've seen stumps blown up. I've seen the old-timers mix ammonium nitrate with diesel. And guess what? You can make a small little bomb worthy enough to blow out some stumps out of the ground. They started doing that. I don't know when they outlawed dynamite, but I remember my grandpa telling me that they used to have a quarter stick of dynamites on the farm that they would use to just eliminate stumps, to dig out ponds, to, you know, loosen dirt and so forth, back before they had big excavation equipment. And he said that when they outlawed dynamite, everybody started using the AMFO stuff. And so I grew up seeing it. It was no big deal. There was a guy, and this is a pretty funny story. I remember telling some friends this online one time, and they thought it was hilarious too. But there was an old timer near our old farm, and I had met him a few times, but he had a crow problem. There were crows just all over his place, and they kept nesting this one part of his property, and they were ticking him off. It was like a little pecan orchard, and running his trees, because when they nest there, they just destroy everything with their waste and so forth. And so he got the wise idea. He was going to dig a hole, and he put ammonium nitrate in the hole, and somehow got a fuse to it and lit it, and it blew up. It scared the crows away. And he was like, dadgummit, you know, that's got to kill them. Because all the ammonium nitrate does is it makes an air blast. It's kind of like an air cannon. It just blasts. And the further away you get from the epicenter, the weaker it gets. And it gets weaker exponentially, too. It's not set. It's every little step out you get from the source, it gets, like I said, exponentially weaker. And so he got the wise idea. He set a couple of them, and he filled it with this small, fine little gravel we had around the area. It was like teeny, teeny. It was smaller than pea gravel. And he put it over the top. It was almost like cat litter. He actually got the birds. It didn't pierce them. It was like a giant shotgun he had built. And he killed a lot of the crows because it hit them so hard, it just killed them. But the point is, it was like 10, 15 feet from the crows, and it wasn't a lot of AMFO, but it was enough that it took a projectile to kill them. The air blast didn't do it. And so I mention that because guess what? That's what the federal government claimed brought down the Murrah building was an air blast. It was an AMFO bomb. It was an AMFO bomb that delivered an air blast that brought down this building with these 6 foot wide columns in front and three foot wide columns on the second and third row. They claim that happened. Now, with an AMFO bomb, one thing you've got to remember, too, is it's ammonium nitrate. And one of the byproducts whenever you blow up an ammonium nitrate bomb, and I've smelled it, is strong ammonium. If, you know, you were into sports or anybody you know, when you pass out, they take that little ammonium stick and they crack it open, and it'll wake you right up because it's straight ammonium or ammonia, and it's stout stuff. That's the same kind of gas that's around after an AMFO bomb goes off. And we know from other bombings that have happened around the world. I know there was one in Saudi Arabia, I believe it was late 80s, early 90s. And then there was one in the 70s at a university. I can't remember the name of the university right off. But both of those were at Amphibomb. And both of those, guess what? They had this strong ammonium after it happened, and it was strong for 15 to 30 minutes afterwards, and the rescue workers couldn't work. And in fact, the one at the university, the rescue workers that came in there, every one of them had to go to the hospital for inhalation problems because they'd all inhaled these lungs full of ammonium. Guess what? There was none of that at Oklahoma City bombing. At the Murrah building, there was no ammonium. There was ammonium, present at all. Rescue workers were coming right in there immediately. People were fleeing from there. Nobody remembers seeing it at all. There's video camera footage from news stations that were there that were on scene within minutes of the bomb that went off. And guess what? Not one of them talks about a breathing hazard. The only part that was hazardous were the cars that were ignited in the parking lot across the street from the Murrah building. The tires are burning on them and magnesium rims, and they're putting off a thick black smoke in the air. There was no ammonia, nothing. Now, there was a brigadier general, I think he was in the Air Force, I think. His name's Benton K. Parton. He did a report. He had been stationed at Tinker Air Force Base. He was widely recognized as one of the most decorated military men when it came to understanding explosions. And not only that, but being able to show up where an explosion happened and tell you exactly what took place. He was trained in that. He had written report after report on it. He volunteered his time. He was retired. He came in. He wasn't allowed on scene, I don't think, to the Murrah building, but he talked to eyewitnesses. And he also was able to look at photographic evidence and compare all the photographs and so forth and look at what happened. And he flat out said this was not an ammonium nitrate bomb that brought this building down. It was planted explosives on the columns brought it down. And he said some of the same things I mentioned a minute ago. If you remember, I said if it was a bomb out front of any kind, it would have blown everything to the back of the building and out the back of the building. Guess what? Stuff was blown across the street, and not only a little, I'm talking a lot of it. Against the Journal Record building, there was a good 4-foot pile of junk out of the Murrah building blown. So how does a bomb blow up and stuff leap over it into the Journal Record building? It sounds, you know, it's implausible. It doesn't happen. Another thing you said, which I mentioned, is the selectiveness of the columns. Some of the columns were eliminated. Some of them weren't. Columns next to each other were still standing, and then ones behind it were eliminated. And it was real sporadic the way they were. And not only that, the columns fell straight down. If they would have been eliminated by a bomb, a truck bomb in front of the building, they would have, some of them closer to the street would have been disintegrated, and they would have been blown back. They fell straight down and rolled into Fifth Street. They rolled in front of the building. I mean, like I said, you have a guy that has investigated bombs his entire life and patterns of explosion that comes out and says, you know what, this is bullcrap, this whole story. But he went further than that. He found out that he tested, he said, you know what, if the bomb was, let's say, 5,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate and fertilizer oil, that's what it stands for, ammonium nitrate and fertilizer oil. But anyways, if it had blown up, the first columns of the building would only receive 375 pounds per square inch of force from the air blast. That's not enough to even damage them. That's enough to blow out windows. That might be enough to rip off some sheetrock off the walls. It might be enough. It's going to be enough to blow papers around. It's going to be enough to break people's eardrums. It's going to be enough to hurt people, probably kill people right there that were standing in front of the building. But it's not going to knock columns down. Those concrete columns, the building was built in 77 before they really started pushing the commercial code in Oklahoma City. But I know that after that and during that time, every bit of concrete in that area was specced out between 5 and 6,500 pounds. Some of it later on was specced even higher than that. So what I'm getting at, it would have taken 5,000 to 6,500 pounds per square inch of pressure to disintegrate those columns, to make them fail. And not only that, when you look at the front columns, like I said, they were 6 foot across, and they had a granite facade on them that was three and a half inches thick. And the rebar inside the columns was number 11 and number 14 rebar with some number 4. And what that means, it was 11, number 4 rebar is half inch rebar. Number 11 rebar is 1 3/8 rebar. Number 14 rebar is 3/4 inch rebar. It was big honking rebar. And we're supposed to believe an air blast of 375 PSI made those things just shear in two. I work in construction all day, and I'm telling you, if rebar did that in the real world, not a house would be standing right now, because just a little bit of wind outside my home, you know, at 60 miles an hour, would blow my house down.
Well, expert opinions really don't matter when you have the government giving its word.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. Some of the other things that he discovered, and I'll just go through briefly. One of them, and this is pretty major to think about too, the federal government, they put a lot of effort trying to duplicate the Oklahoma City bombing. They went to Fort Riley, I believe, was the place they went. They did experiments. They built a little three-story concrete building, and they even built a steel building at first too, just a normal steel building. They talked to Tim McVeigh, and they said, how many drums of this ampho bomb do you have in there? And he told them, and nonetheless, they tried to blow it up in front of the steel building. It did no damage to the steel building at all. The charges, every barrel offset each other, and it made one air blast that shot straight up the truck. That's all it did. And the federal government was like, damn it, we did exactly what he said. It didn't work. You know, this little, military guy, you know, he pulled it off and we can't. And so they made it bigger. They tried 4,000 pounds at first, or 3,500 pounds. They made it 7,000 pounds. Still didn't work. Made air blast go straight up. And so they got the bright idea. They said, we're going to eliminate the drums. And what we're going to do is make one big bomb in the back of 7,000 pounds. So they did it. They took it in front of this three-story concrete building that was far inferior to the Murrah building. I mean, it was like chopsticks compared to a big bulky building. I mean, it was just nothing. It was thin concrete, you know, poorly shoddy made real quickly. And they blew it up in front. Guess what? They blew the windows out. It didn't damage the concrete at all. Every floor was still there. The columns are still there. The federal government said, we have made it happen. We have duplicated the bomb. This is what happened. And you look at you kind of wring your hand and say, what the hell? How can you call that you made it happen when you used twice as much stuff as you said? You did it differently than what the bomb maker said he did. And not only that, you couldn't even blow up a little matchstick building, you dummies. I mean, what are you thinking? And so that's kind of what this brigadier general said. He said, you know, there's no way. And so what they claimed is every square inch of that truck was covered with bomb from the very back of the truck to the front bumper was bomb, even under the engine compartment. And he said, bull, there's no way that happened, because the front axle of the truck was blown one block east near the YMCA building, and the other axle, the rear axle, was blown one block west by the Regency Tower. So you had the axles blown two blocks apart from each other, and not only that, that means the bomb was right between the axles. And whatever it was, it pushed downward, made a small crater, and it pushed and drove the truck apart. The truck was demolished. I mean, it was gone. But aside from that, the bomb didn't do much of anything. It may have blown out some windows. It may have blown some paper around, but it didn't do anything. It did nothing. I'll never forget, I was talking to a FEMA fireman. We had, I think it was 2 or 3 days into the bombing, we had a bunch of FEMA guys show up, and they were from other fire departments around the country. Miami-Dade, Florida showed up, some from, I believe, Baltimore, and then New York City showed up, and some from LA, California, too. And I was talking to I had a friend of mine who I was a fireman with. He'd grown up on Long Island, and his friend was a New York City fireman. And that friend actually showed up as part of FEMA. The FEMA group to work there. And so he introduced me. He goes, man, I grew up with this guy. We're best friends. He's still a Yankee, though. I'm down here in Oklahoma, you know, and we're hobnobbing around and having a good time. And this guy flat looked at me. He goes, you know, I was there, one of the rescue workers during the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And he goes, what you have here is not what happened there. He goes, what we had there was, we had a truck bomb blow up in the basement of the World Trade Center. And it eliminated a few floors above it and below it, but all the columns are still intact. He goes, what you have here is, you have a truck that was outside. It wasn't in an enclosed parking garage like that. But he goes, it was supposedly outside the truck, and it blew up all these columns selectively, what columns it wanted to, and it left others standing. He goes, bull crap. He goes, there were charges in that building. And he goes, I know that, and I can tell you that right now without ever, you know, seeing an official report. And so here was an outsider that had seen another bombing that told me and my friend another group of firefighters that official story they're concocting is bullcrap. And so, and that was really strong for me as a young guy, because I was, you know, starting to lose faith in, like I said, the government at that point. I thought, oh my gosh, what's going on here? I needed answers. And here this experienced guy with 20 years, you know, or so on his fire department was telling me this. So I thought, you know, good on you, man. You're able to describe what I'm seeing here, that this isn't lining up with what Justin knows, what Justin has seen with small explosions and construction all of his life. So, but one of the last and probably saddest things that I'll mention, I should have put this earlier, but about conflictions, and then we'll kind of get some questions and answers here in a minute, are the mysterious deaths. I'm going to kind of go different than my notes are here, but there are, by best estimates, around 30 mysterious deaths surrounding the Oklahoma City bombing that took place after the bombing. Every one of them had a common connection. Some of them knew each other, but every one of them were a first responder, or there's one of them that wasn't. I'll mention him in a minute, but every one of them was a first responder, and they saw things that were contradictory to the official story. And because they were contradictory to the official story, and because they were vocal, guess what? They had mysterious deaths. Some of them died. Their deaths were ruled suicide. Some of them died in unusual auto accidents, just weird auto accidents. One of them died in a weird plane crash I'll talk about. But the first one I'm going to mention was an Oklahoma City police officer. I never met him. I knew a good friend of his who had been one of his littermates, as we called it. It was somebody who had got on the police department at the same time as him that was really mad when this guy died. I mean, he was so angry at his superiors. He was so angry at the official story. But this police officer that died, his name was Terrence Yeeke. He was the first police officer on scene at the bombing. He had been riding a ticket around the corner from there, and he heard the bomb go off, and he knew he needed to go immediately. He just dropped his ticket book and ran. And he started, over the next 6 months, compiling evidence that was contradictory to the official story. He started compiling eyewitness accounts, photographs, contraband photographs and so forth, as we call them, and might have had actual videotapes of a closed-circuit television. We don't know. It's rumored he did. But he was storing these in a little storage unit in El Reno, Oklahoma, which El Reno was due west of Oklahoma City. Old Fort Reno is what it is. And he had been with some friends and family members and was supposed to go eat dinner with him that night. He was supposedly, from everything I've ever read and heard, and I've seen videotapes of him when he was still alive at family reunions and stuff, and seemed like a pretty happy-go-lucky guy. He was happy, you know, kind of high on life kind of guy. And he went to go put his stuff in his storage unit. He was never seen again. The next day, a Canadian County Sheriff deputy found his body. It was lying in an old wheat field, and it was ruled a suicide immediately. But when you read the medical examiner's report and you talk to his people that know about it, and it makes you cringe. He'd been beaten. His wrist had been sliced. He had ligature marks on his neck and his wrist. He had his body was bruised. Throughout his palms of his hands were bruised, his soles of his feet were bruised. He had knots on his head where he'd been beaten. He had 13 stab wounds in his body, and some of them were in his back in the kidney area, and up higher than that, kind of the thoracic region of the spine, an area that is almost impossible. I can touch mine, but I probably couldn't stab myself there very easy. But he had 13 stab wounds, and not only that, but he had been shot with a .22 caliber small pistol, which is classic, by the way, assassination style, like the Mossad and the CIA are famous for using little .22 pistols to knock off people at point-blank range. But he had been shot in the back of the skull point-blank. Now, he was also anemic, which means he would bleed out quickly. If he got a cut, he was going to die. His car was found a half mile from his body. The bloody knife was in it. So we're supposed to believe he beat the hell out of himself. He strangled himself. He cut his wrist. He bruised his body. He did classic torture-style stuff to his own self, shot himself in the head. The gun was gone. And he walked a half mile and died. I mean, this guy, I'm sorry.
Shot himself in the back of the head, too, right?
I'm sorry, this guy was awesome, man. This guy could not die, is what I'm saying.
Wow.
And not only that, but the sheriff deputy, when he got there, noticed the entire scene around where Terrence was found had been overturned with a spade shovel. Every bit of it had been disrupted. And around the car, it had been wiped clean, too. The only thing that wasn't wiped clean, guess what? The bloody knife. The knife that had stabbed him was found in the front seat of the car, and there were no fingerprints on the handle. No autopsy was ever conducted. The federal agents came through, and his superiors supported it, the Oklahoma City Police, and shame on them, doom on them for this. One of their own. They're supposed to, you know, police are supposed to be a brotherhood. They're supposed to take care of each other, supposedly. They didn't. They turned on him in a heartbeat on this, and they said, screw him, he's off on his own. They did nothing for the family. They were treated as trash. Every time the family tried to go to the police officers, they said, look, your family member was a nutcase. He knew nothing. He was just distraught, and he went and killed himself because he's a friggin' retard. And that's kind of the way they treated him and talked to him. You know, and so like I said, curse them for that. But the next death I'll talk about is a very unusual one. And I remember when it happened, and it made local news. It never really made national news much, but it made local news because it was an unusual one. But there's a guy named Kenneth Trinitou was his name. He had been he was the only guy that was killed out of the 30 or 31 people that did not ever step foot at the bombing. He was the only one. And it's unusual, like I said. He was locked up in the Oklahoma County Jail. He had a parole violation. He had had some felonies, and he was trying to clean his life up, and he just not reported to his parole officer. So they said, you know what, we're going to lock you up for 2 months. Big deal. Well, 3 days later, he's dead. And the FBI was quick to get there, and the FBI, and this is unusual, the FBI claimed it was suicide by hanging. But according to Oklahoma state law, if somebody dies in prison or in a jail, county jail or state or a city jail, the case needs to have a medical examiner examine the body. Well, the FBI requested via the telephone, don't examine him, it's a suicide by hanging, we know what happened. Well, the medical examiner for the county of Oklahoma examined him anyways, because guess what? His job was on the line, and he wasn't going to lose his job because a bunch of, you know, dumb feds. And so they get there, and their report, they're like, oh, you can't release it, but it was released anyways. This is public record. You can actually go pull this for there's a fee, but still, the point is, you can do a public information request and get this report. They found he'd been beaten. He had finger grip marks on his arms and the legs where somebody had held him in a chair. The palms of his hands were bruised. The soles of his feet were bruised. He had three almost lethal blows to the back of his head. He had ligature marks, which are strangulation marks on the neck. His throat had been sliced almost from ear to ear. And we're supposed to believe he hanged himself. And even more mysterious than this, his clothes ended up missing. There were traces of blood. They went and did a luminance test the next day, the medical examiner, in his jail cell, and it had been wiped clean. He walked in there and smelled bleach. But guess what? Bleach doesn't take away. If you ever watch, you know, that's one thing, like, you know, on TV shows like Dexter and crime scene shows and stuff like that, they go through and they do the little luminance test with the black light and so forth and spraying the chemical, and it shows the traces of blood. There was blood on the ceiling, the floor, the walls. It was a bloodbath in his jail cell. And it was ruled a hanging. Now, where Kenneth comes in is he fit the identical description of John Doe number 2. He had the same kind of tattoo on his arm. It was a dragon tattoo. He resembled him facially. He had the same stature. He was a stocky, shorter guy, 5'7"-ish, 5'8", kind of stocky and, you know, real muscular. And he fit the classic example of John Doe number 2. And his brother, Kenneth's brother, is a lawyer in Denver, Colorado. He was trying to investigate and figure, why did my brother die? This is not a suicide. He was killed. What happened? He had two different phone calls in the middle of the night from anonymous phone callers, unidentified numbers, didn't come up on the caller ID. And both callers said the same thing. They were a few months apart. They both said, your brother was a case of an FBI interrogation gone bad. It was a case of mistaken identity. They thought he was somebody else. I'm sorry for this. And that was it. Why? Because John Doe number 2, if you remember early on in Oklahoma City bombing lore, was supposedly right there riding shotgun with Timothy McVeigh when the bomb went off. He was the second guy. And there was the biggest manhunt in the history of America for almost 3 months looking for this guy, John Doe number 2. He's gone.
I heard about this guy. I think, doesn't he have a brother that goes around and talks about this?
He does. His brother's a lawyer. Yeah. I've heard him. He's a very knowledgeable man, and God bless him for what he's done. I mean, he had no connection with Oklahoma City bombing, but because of what happened to his brother, they picked on the wrong guy. They pissed the wrong guy off, is what I'm telling you. Mm-hmm. This guy has been a firebrand for the feds. I mean, he has come in and said, you know what, screw you guys. I'm a lawyer, and I'm going to tell you what you've done illegally. And not only that, I'm going to show you that you guys have screwed up because you killed my brother. So the next guy I'm going to talk about, this, I'm not going to talk about all 31, by the way. I just got two more briefly. But Michael Loudenslager, he was a government employee with the GSA. I think that's General Services of America is what it stands for. It's a government agency. They kind of do, I think, logistics and things like that for the government, some variety. He was a pencil pusher for him. But in the weeks prior to the bombing, he worked in the Murrah building. He had filed a complaint about the ATF, that they had stored military-grade ordnance in the building. And that was illegal because there was no bunker in there, or no locker for it in there. It wasn't safe. And not only that, there was a daycare on the second floor of the Murrah building. They couldn't have it. Excuse me. You can't, by law, have military ordnance within so many feet of a daycare. And here's the one in the same dadgum building. And so he alerted the daycare. He alerted the ATF. And they kind of brushed him off and said, oh, we don't store anything in here. There's nothing in here. We don't even have any guns in here. We don't even, not even any ammo in here. We're just innocent little ATF boys, you know, having a party in here. And anyways, a few days before the bombing went off, and I don't know how he found out, but somehow it came across his wire that there was going to be an attempt on the building. The building was going to be blown up. He didn't know a day, but he knew it was going to happen. And so he went and warned people that he knew that their children were in the daycare, said, be on high alert. It's going to blow up, and it's going to blow up soon. That's all I know. It's going to blow up. Well, the morning of Oklahoma City, of April 19th, he was at the federal courthouse one block south. It was right behind the Murrah building. He was in court. He was actually testifying at the time it went off. And that's important. He was testifying. And despite being seen there and being in court, and they have on court record that he was there, and despite numerous eyewitnesses, including his family, seeing him for 3 or 4 days, guess what? 4 days into the bombing, in an area that had already been cleared by fire department personnel, they found his body at his desk in the Murrah building. And it had no debris on it whatsoever. Most of the bodies that we found, you could tell they had been in an explosion. There was dust all over their bodies. Some of their bodies... I won't get graphic. I'm not going to go there. But the point is, you could tell they'd been in an explosion. He had nothing. He looked like he had just been shot or strangled or something and put his desk. And the fire department said, no. We've already cleared this room. There is no way that he died there. But guess what? He's counted as a victim of the bombing despite being in court when the bomb happened and living for 4 days after the bombing happened. And guess what? It's because he had information prior to the bombing. He messed with the wrong people, and they took him out, and it's pretty obvious. The last guy I'll mention, he was a doctor, Dr. Don Chumley. He worked at a clinic around the corner from the Murrah building, and he was one of the first responders on scene, him and his son-in-law. And Dr. Chumley was one of the only doctors to go in the Murrah building after the bomb went off. He was one of two or three doctors, highly skilled guy, you know, in trauma. He knew what to look for and so forth. And he saw things that were against the official story. He spoke out for 6 months after the official story, or I guess not 6 months, it'd be 5 months. Because 5 months after the bombing, guess what happened? He had his own Cessna plane. It was a Cessna 210. He was flying out of Amarillo, Texas. He had been a well-seasoned pilot. He had over 600 hours in that Cessna alone, plus his flight time in other planes. So, I mean, he was a well-seasoned guy. And he had been in the air for 15 minutes. He asked aircraft control, said, hey, can I ascend from 6,000 to 7,000 feet? Can I go up in elevation? They said, sure, you're clear to go. And he leveled off at about 6,900 feet. And as soon as he did that, the plane went into a straight nosedive and he crashed and died. Now, here's the funny part about all this. When the FAA came out and investigated, they found out the cruise control was still set. They also found out the flaps were still up. And I'm not a pilot, but I've been in enough planes, and especially enough Cessnas, I've actually been in a Cessna 210, that when the flaps are up, that means the plane's leveled off or gaining slightly in altitude. And when the cruise control sets, that probably means that he's going straight. He wasn't descending. He wasn't going down. And the FBI got involved and said quickly, said, well, it was apparent suicide. He was distraught over what he saw at the Oklahoma City bombing. He nosedived the plane in there. And the FAA said, no, this did not happen. And then there was a dispute whether it was bad weather or not bad weather. And they determined that even if it was bad weather, this guy had some sort of instrument cluster that allowed him to maneuver through the bad weather. And he had done it before successfully. And he was, a skilled pilot, seasoned pilot. And according to his friends, he was one of the best pilots that they knew. And they trusted him to fly through the sort of little bit of inclement weather he was in that day. And so what happened? He had the story is, according to his son-in-law, the day of the bombing, there were some ATF agents that wanted to be treated. They were feigning that they had an injury. They came and said, oh, we're injured. Look at us. We're hurt. We're distraught, and so forth. And he looked at them and said, you know what? You guys aren't hurt. I'm doing triage here. You're level, you're the lowest level. You're not even hurt. You need to go wait over there. And they got mad at him. And he threatened to report him. He said, I'm going to report you guys. You don't quit it. He goes, there's people here that are walking wounded, is what we call them, that need medical attention. They could die. They may die. And so he got into it with ATF agents. And supposedly, according to his son-in-law who was there, one of the ATF agents said, you better watch your back. We're going to get you. Well, I'm afraid they got Mr. Chumley or Dr. Chumley. And like I said, he was very outspoken the months preceding his death after the bombing. He spoke out and said, you know what? This is bull. This building did not come down with a Ryder truck bomb. It did not. And like I said, aside from these four that I just mentioned their stories, there's 26 or 27 more that ended the same way. Mysterious car crashes, another plane crash, suicides, heart attacks, you name it. And it's all in this small circle of people that were protesting, which is one of the reasons, me and other firemen early on, we started seeing some of these deaths and even police officers. We'd talk about it behind closed doors at the fire station occasionally. We'd be like, there's another death here, another mysterious death. What do you do with this? And, and so we kind of all agreed, it's best to keep our mouth closed because, as they say, snitches end up in ditches. And we were scared. I had a young family, I didn't have a young family. I had a new wife at the time, and then we had kids right after, and I didn't want to lose them. And so, before I take some questions, I'd like to talk about what I think are some of the reasons behind the Oklahoma City bombing. I've had almost 18 years to go through it, and I've gone through every little avenue I can, trying to sort it out. I want answers. I want to know, why did these bastards do what they did? Who are these people? Who are they? And this is the best I can figure. It's been suggested, and I think this is very plausible, and this may be just anecdotal. It may just be it happened, just a happenstance. But Bill Clinton was president at the time. And if you remember all the Bill Clinton lore, he was bedding every gal he could in Arkansas and was a pretty horny guy there. And not only that, there were a lot of mysterious deaths surrounding Mena, Arkansas. And it's been proven that there was drug running going on. There was also the Iran-Contra training program where they were training these Contra pilots or Colombian pilots. They were training them there to go run drugs and run weapons down in South America and Central America. And not only that, but there was Vince Foster's death. Vince Foster was a close friend of Bill Clinton, and his was another death that happened in Washington. Was ruled a suicide, but everybody that saw the body said, the body was hauled here. It was shot somewhere else, and there was no gun found, that matched the description of the bullet that killed him. So you had all these weird things that happened in a short time leading up to the Oklahoma City bombing. Well, guess what was stored at the Murrah Building? Every file on Bill Clinton and his involvement in Arkansas and all these other little things, from his escapades to the deaths and so forth and the drug running, it was all stored in the Murrah Building. And Bill Clinton, if you remember before the Murrah Building went off, there's a common thread I've noticed with all these false flag operations. Right before they happen, the U.S. president at the time is usually going way down in his points. I mean, he is dipping down in the public opinion. They're like, wow, this guy's worthless. But after it happens, man, you'd think the guy walked on water. If you remember 9/11, the same thing happened with old W. Bush. Everybody was down on Bush, but after 9/11 happened, they were like, oh my gosh, Bush is the hero. Even liberals were saying that. They were praising Bush. Same thing with Clinton. Well, I don't know that the bomb went off to hide the paperwork that was in the bombing, but I know that a lot of it was destroyed. And that could have been, like I said, a coincidence, but it's a strange coincidence if it was. I think personally, probably one of the main reasons the bomb went off and the Murrah building was destroyed was because the government did not like the liberty-minded kind of militia groups, whether they're racially aware or not, what their involvement was with believing, who was behind banking or who was running the government. The point is the government saw all these groups as a threat, and they labeled them all racist and said, we need to shut them down. And they claim before 1995, they'd infiltrated about every one of them in the United States. And I do know that statistically, according to groups that monitor, like the SPLC monitors and the ADL, they monitor supposed hate groups, they call them, that are in a hate group just means, guess what? It could mean I grow a garden in my backyard. It's something that simple, but and I like to do that. But the point is in 1995, right before the Oklahoma City bombing, they were at an all-time high in America. Anti-government sentiment was at an all-time high, too. People were mad. People were upset. Farms were being shut down all across the Midwest. I had family members lose farms. I knew people that lost farms. And not only that, banks had run dry. You had oil, all the oil embargoes. You had all the nonsense. You had assault. The assault weapons ban. You had all this nonsense going on with Clinton, and people were pissed off. And guess what? They were joining these groups, and the government saw them as a threat. And I think the bombing primarily was designed to shut those down, because the year 1996, after the bombing, those groups dipped to an all-time low. Now, right now, in 2013, we're back above. We entered 2011. We actually rose above the number of liberty-minded groups past 1995 level, so we're getting back up there again. And so, like, so expect something to happen someday soon, to try to squelch us out a little bit. But to go along with that, I think the government and whoever was behind the Oklahoma City bombing, they like to cause chaos, and by causing chaos, it forces people to trust the government and to make them more submissive. What is it about? It's about control. They want to be able to control people. They want to be able to take them and make them so submissive to the government they'll believe anything the government says. They're the perfect masters, according to their little sheep. And so, and lastly, I think the last reason is they wanted to test the waters for further false flag operations. I firmly believe that 9/11 was a false flag operation. I believe the Pentagon was too, and nonetheless, I believe it was a lot. It was just like Oklahoma City, but a lot bigger in scope. I believe Oklahoma City was their training ground. It was for them to iron out any glitches they might have to get things tested. And they did, because guess what? There were a lot of sloppy glitches in Oklahoma City. So I could go on and on with some other stuff. I'm going to just refrain. I recommend people to research Elohim City a little bit. I'll briefly mention that Tim McVeigh did go there, and there were some, but Elohim City, it was in eastern Oklahoma. It was a militia group over there, supposedly a white supremacy group, and there's no proof really of that. There is some, but then there's not. It depends on who you talk to, but they were loaded with federal agents. One of them was Andreas Strassmeyer. Another was Carol Howell from Tulsa, Oklahoma. They were federal informants, one with the FBI, one with the CIA, and their involvement with the Oklahoma City bombing, they may have been involved. We don't know. We don't know to what level they were involved. We just know that they were involved with Timothy McVeigh somehow. And but like I said, I encourage people to read about that. I could go on for quite a while about that one. And lastly, before I take any questions, I recommend – I've not read, honestly, because I was there. I saw it, and I don't read a lot about Oklahoma City bombing, but I've read a couple of books about it, and one of the best I think there is The Oklahoma City Bombing and the Politics of Terror by David Hoffman. Another is The Secret Life of Bill Clinton, The Unprecedented Stories by Ambrose Evans Pritchard. I bought the last one I just mentioned because of Bill Clinton, but he does one of the best concise, he dissects Elohim City, for instance. and the Oklahoma City bombing in a way that it just it's unprecedented. It's really good. And for people like the films, I highly recommend The Noble Lie. A friend of mine up here in Idaho, Stan, got me the film, and I knew it'd come out. I knew one of the producers, and I was planning on getting it, and it just not got around to it because it's kind of depressing for me to watch it sometimes because of what I saw and heard. And but after watching, I've watched it three times now. I recommend it to everybody. I think everybody in America, I think it's required viewing. I think people need to watch it because it's a part of our history. And if we don't know our history, we're doomed to repeat it. So
that's called A Noble Lie.
A Noble Lie. You can pick it up. It was released in, I think, 2011 or 2012, and it's about 2 hours long almost. But they go through some of the same stuff I mentioned here. There's some things I mentioned they don't go through.
Yeah.
But they do one of the most thorough jobs of any film that I've seen. So, but I'm open to questions. I see we have a few more minutes.
Yeah, we'll do that. This is Tribal Theocrat Live. We're wrapping up with Justin Cottrell on the Oklahoma City bombing. If you have questions and you're in the chat room, ask those. We'll ask them. To Justin, I have a question myself for you, Justin. What did Timothy McVeigh himself have to say about this after he was arrested? I don't know much about it. Did he talk? Did he say he was a patsy?
You know, he said a lot of things, and what he said and what he didn't say, we don't know. It's kind of like Lee Harvey Oswald. We don't know who the real guy was. We do know that what he had told Terry Nichols, the guy, supposed co-conspirator of the Oklahoma City bombing, he flat told Terry, I'm a government agent, and I'm out to infiltrate militia-type groups and anti-government groups to bring them down, to set them up. And that's what he told him. He said, I'm trying to set them up. But in the process, I really think he got set up. I believe that he really was in downtown Oklahoma City. I believe he probably did blow up a Ryder truck, and possibly because he was so brainwashed by, you know, kind of an MK Ultra program, I believe that he thinks he may have brought down the building. He was that brainwashed, but he didn't know that what the hidden hand was doing. And that's kind of the same way as all these false flag operations. Same way with Lee Harvey Oswald. Lee Harvey, I think he shot a gun at the president. I think he probably missed him, you know, like missing a barn. But in his mind, he probably thinks he killed JFK before he died. He probably thought that. He didn't know what the hidden hand was doing around Dallas that day. The same with Tim McVeigh. But Tim McVeigh gave some unusual stuff at times. There were times that he, for instance, he told his family that he'd been sheep dipped, for instance. And sheep dipped is an old term that means that it's when somebody takes a new identity and tries to make themselves somebody new that's in the government. And they usually do that before they infiltrate a group. And he told his sister that. His sister testified sometime around the time of his death. And said, yeah, he told me he'd been sheep dipped. And so Timothy McVeigh, this all-star soldier boy that was gung-ho on, I love the military, he goes to Buffalo, New York. He comes back a few months later, and all of a sudden he hates the government, wants to kill them all, you know, tear them all up. And his sister, he told his sister at the time, I'd been sheep dipped. And she didn't understand at the time.
Explain that to me. What does sheep dipped mean again?
Dipped is essentially where they take and they infiltrate a group and they take the ideals and ideas of that group and they become indoctrinated with them and try to fool the group into believing that they are a part of that group. And so it's just an old term, meaning they're changing their identity. And so he went to Buffalo, New York and learned how to be a white supremacist, militant, anti-government guy is what I'm telling you.
I got you.
He wasn't one, but he went there and learned how to do it. And he told his sister that. And his sister scratched her head and said the same thing. He said, what the heck's sheep dip? What are you talking about?
Right.
You know? So, but next question. You got another one?
I don't see any in the chat room. If anyone has a question, please ask it.
By the way, just be me and you on here.
Say what?
It could just be me and you on here.
There's been a lot of helpful links as you've been talking, Justin, that Mickey Henry's been dropping in the chat room for people to explore these resources. So we will leave those links up for the next couple weeks before we clear that out for the next show. But this has been a very outstanding 2 hours of lesson on what happened almost 18 years ago. I wonder what do they typically do? You know, how every anniversary of an event like this comes by, what do they typically do? The media and the establishment, how do they talk about this as the anniversary comes up?
That's one thing that, for instance, Oklahoma City, they have a memorial there, and I've never been in the memorial because I'm really pissed off about it still. I'm really angry because I know damn well that they did us wrong. We don't have the straight story. I know darn well that, you know, it's been a concocted, harebrained story that they've tried to pass by us. And every year at the memorial on April 19th, they have a ceremony and they have 169 seconds of silence because 169 people died. It's kind of weird. It's as low as 168 and high as 170 because some of them were pregnant. But nonetheless, they have a ceremony, and family members will show up. But it was funny is people that lost family members there. I've met a lot of them, and I've never met one that trusts the government story. Every one of them questions it. Every single one of them. And I've been to one of the ceremonies early on, but after that, I decided I was never going to go to another because I thought it'd be different. I thought it was going to be people getting up there saying, "I want to know the truth," but no, it wasn't. It was, "Oh, you know, woe is us. Timothy McVeigh blew us all to smithereens and killed our family. Let's say a prayer." Or no, they didn't even say a prayer. Let's just have a moment of silence, you know? And so, but you mentioned the media. This is unusual. The film, The Noble Lie, that I mentioned, they do the best job I've ever seen on this. They mentioned the three major news channels that we had in Oklahoma City. For the first couple of weeks, all three of them were saying some great stuff. They were saying stuff that, like I'm saying tonight, saying, "Whoa, there's contradictions here. This isn't the true story. You know, what's going on here?" Within 2 weeks, ABC and the CBS affiliate, both of them had followed the mainline story. The only one that stuck with it was NBC, and they stuck with it for a year. They interviewed witnesses. They interviewed several in, you know, dark rooms and masked their voices and stuff. And nonetheless, guess what? They were bought out a year, year and a half after the Oklahoma City bombing by the New York Times. And the station manager was fired. The lead reporter who had interviewed most of the people for Oklahoma City bombing was fired. And anybody that had any sort of story like mine that doubted the official story, guess what? They were fired as well. And now the NBC affiliate, the reporters that are still there, that were there in Oklahoma City bombing, guess what? They've adopted the official story. So there you have it. What happens is you get bought out. You have to accept the official story or you lose your job. So, and I just saw somebody mentioned Sandy Hook was the same way. Absolutely. Yeah. I'll never forget Sandy Hook that after it happened, seeing the videotape from the helicopter, them wrestling some guy in black, you know, duds out in the wilderness down or the woods behind the school. And nothing's ever mentioned about that now. We're supposed to believe some little, you know, 105-pound anorexic-looking kid that looks scared for his life was hauled in 100 pounds of ammo and and guns and blasted everybody to smithereens. It's like, you know what? The kid looks crazy. Yeah, I admit it. But come on. It's not possible, people. And what happened to the person in the woods? What happened to the other people that were seen running away? What happened to the shotgun that was found in the trunk, the M16 that was found in the car? It's craziness, just complete craziness.
Very, very crazy. Yep, we'll probably hear a lot about this in the next couple weeks about, you know, white supremacists and militia movements, and that's bad. Yeah. Don't plant a garden because you might be a homeland terrorist.
Oh, exactly.
Don't be a Ron Paul fan. Don't be an anti-abortion guy.
Yeah. And if you doubt the president, you're a racist.
That's right. Well, this has been a great show. We'll go ahead and wrap up here. Thanks for everybody who participated in the chat room. Eric and Robert and Mickey and Carrie, Anna, Rachel, welcome. And I hope I didn't forget anybody.
Yep. Well, I appreciate everybody listening. It was a pleasure to be on, and I'll have you know, Mr. Theocrat, you were the very first person to ever interview me about the Oklahoma City bombing.
Wow.
On air. You know, I've done a lot of interviews on, you know, serial killers and crime and things like that, and I've done a lot of speeches in person, but I never spoke about the Oklahoma City bombing to an audience, and it was a pleasure to do so. It's taken me years to actually build up the courage to, because I don't know if I'm going to end up a ditch tomorrow. So.
Well,
take some of them with me, okay?
Absolutely. Yeah, we hope you don't end up in a ditch. I'm really grateful for you doing this, the courage to do it, and not just that, but the preparation that it took to get this together. This is 2 hours of great audio. We'll have the podcast up in a couple of days. And tune in a couple of weeks from now. We'll have a guest on talking about agrarianism versus the industrial model. Thanks again for joining us at tribaltheocrat.com.